Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence by Jane's. As usual, your host, Harry Kemsley, and my co-host, Sean Corbett.
Good to be back, Harry.
Good to see you, Sean. So, Sean, we talked about having a revisit to the Arab Spring from about 13, 14 years ago. And to do that, I have three guests with us from the Jane's analytical team. First of all, there's James. Hello, James.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I'm James Trigg. I'm a senior research analyst with the Jane's Country Intelligence team.
Welcome back, James.
Thank you.
Not your first time with us, I know. Maria. Hello, Maria.
Hello. My name is Maria Lambubi, and I'm the principal analyst and manager of the Sub-Saharan Africa Desk.
And welcome back to you, Maria. Good to see you back. Yeah. And then finally, least but not last, or is it last but not least? Lewis. Hello, Lewis.
Hi there, Harry. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm the principal analyst for the Middle East and North Africa Country Intelligence team at Jane's.
Very good. So you've all been on podcasts before. You know how we run these podcasts. What I'm really keen to do is try and focus on the topic, but also, of course, bringing in the power and potential of open source as a place we can derive intelligence value. So we'll do that en route. But maybe what we can do first for the listener is just do a recap of what was the Arab Spring? How did it start? What was it about? James, let me start with you on that.
Thanks. So trying to cover this briefly is always going to be a challenge, but
I'll give you no more than 2 minutes.
2 minutes, right. So the Arab Spring is the phrase currently now given to a series of protests that broke out across the Middle East and North Africa throughout 2011 and 2012. Started with Tunisia, following the self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi, a fruit vendor who was outraged and feeling no respite or no assistance from the government after he was assaulted by police officers, set himself ablaze in front of the governor's office. This triggered a series of protests in Tunisia, people calling for accountability and change in the system from the autocratic system as it was to a more democratic system. These protests spread and were replicated across the Arab world and the Gulf, including Egypt, Yemen, Libya, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, as well as Tunisia. Yeah, that's what I could probably, the best summary I can
give in 2 minutes. Yeah, very good. Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, just for me, I think it's a brilliant case study in terms of, it was almost the start of, if you want to call it, the OSINT revolution, because it was so visible, and actually a lot of it was facilitated by the use of social media and proliferation, that sort of thing. So all the things that we now do, sentiment analysis, getting into some of the politics people have heard me say before that, what sparked it, and one of the key things that sparked it was the price of bread went up because there was a major wheat crisis caused by global drought. Now, that was only one of the triggers, obviously. I have been misquoted before saying, it wasn't just about the wheat. No, it wasn't, because there were serious political, economic and social factors that all led to it. But they are all things that are very valid for, the OSINT practitioner to be looking at.
Yeah, so we often talk about how we characterize the emergence of these crises. And I think what we've just heard from that is the original Arab Spring, we would call it that, had an economic, had a climactic, and it had a political element to it. So if I now come to you, Maria, what's different today? What's happening today? Is there any sign of a similar set of circumstances that might foment another version of an Arab Spring?
Well, I was taking a lot of notes as James and Sean were talking, and a few of the key words that sort of struck out to me were particularly rising food prices, alleged police or security forces brutality, protests, the use of social media to organize. And these are all elements that we continue to see in the continent. I will be, of course, touching on Sub-Saharan Africa mainly. So the economic conditions in the countries, the disproportionate effects of Russia's invasion in Ukraine and the subsequent rise in grain import prices, or the the decrease in the amount of grain that the countries were importing, along with more autocratic regimes, less professional security forces that have been often accused of human rights abuses. All of these elements are still present today, alongside climate change induced food insecurity. The droughts are still persistent across the continent. We see a lot of displacement of population as well. All elements that have led in some cases to protests. I will quote a few. Nigeria a few years ago, linked to police brutality, that resulted in a response from the government that was to some extent enough for the protesters. We saw Sudan sort of more linked to the Arab Spring, the original one, where protests resulted in a change in government. However, even though all these elements are still present, I think when it comes to sub-Saharan Africa, we are still probably lacking that unifying cause, that common element that probably led to the Arab Spring originally being contagious from one country.
James, let me just come back to you for a second, just to try and draw some parallels there. So we saw an event or series of circumstances and an event in Tunisia that then sparked a sort of wave of other events. They were connected and then became later known as the Arab Spring. What Maria's just described, if I understood you correctly, is that there are similar events, similar conditions, but they're not creating this wave effect, this contagion effect. Is there any particular reason why you think that might be today?
That's a big question. Yeah. For example, I can refer to Algeria in 2019 and the protest there that saw, you know, the ousting of President Bouteflika and, you know, elections held. So, as Maria pointed out, these events are still transpiring. As to why the contagion effect is, you know, not as evident as it was in 2010, 2011. I think that's simply because, you know, participants and protesters in these events now and governments and authorities have more historical context to reflect on. Countries do not want to see themselves go the way of, let's say, Syria, which, you know, protests began, triggered by the Arab Spring, led to a civil conflict, which is arguably still ongoing. So I think there's a greater kind of reluctance for overarching sweeping reforms. But I think, as Maria pointed out, and as in Algeria, there's, you know, still scope for local grievances and, you know, smaller scale reforms to occur.
Very good. Lewis, I know you wanted to come in on that.
Yeah, thank you, Harry. I think James and Maria both made great points there. And I think it's a bit trite to say, but it's the fact that the Arab Spring did occur is one of the things that's different today. It's hindsight. The regimes and governments have learned their lessons to a large degree. And revolutions are hard. You know, they are quite rare, and they're hard things to do. And I think what we've seen is, especially in the case of Egypt, a government learn the lessons, as James was saying, of what can happen. And it kind of reminds me, actually, to get a bit historical, of Europe in the early 1800s, where you had someone like Prince Clemens von Metternich respond to the protests across Europe in a sort of kind of conservative, kind of autocratic alliance between Prussia, Russia, Austria, etc. Now, that didn't, obviously, as we know, stop the revolutions from happening, but it made them much harder. It allowed external powers to work together, etc. So I think the fact that it happened is a trite thing to say, but it's incredibly important for those governments to have learned the lessons. And just to delve a bit deeper into Egypt on this, because I think it's a great case study. We've obviously got the president, Fatah al-Sisi, who is the president. And since he's come to power, we've seen the almost complete suppression of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which was one of the main organized actors that got power for a brief period of time following the protests and revolutionary moment in Egypt. They've been banned, they've been outlawed, they've been completely basically run out of the country and exiled. And so a political actor in a country that can take advantage and kind of inspire people to maybe protest because they believe this could be the actor to take over. Those are incredibly important organizations to have in a country. And at the moment, Egypt just doesn't have viable organized social or political opposition against Sisi. So that's one element. The youth are obviously a massive component of kind of revolutionary zeal, of hopes and dreams. But we can see in Egypt, President Sisi targeting the youth to try and co-opt them into his program. So he's been running what's called national youth conferences since 2016, which is basically is described as a forum for direct dialogue between the Egyptian youth and the Egyptian government and the president. Now, it's interesting. There's one recommendation from 2016, which I think was particularly interesting. It says the presidency of Egypt, in coordination with the Council of Ministers and a group of youth symbols, to prepare a political vision to inaugurate a national center for training and qualifying youth cadres. So that's a really important element. And I think that also builds in to Sisi's kind of emphasis on nationalism in Egypt. He's saying that I am the representative of the Egyptian people and its state, and to go against me is to tear the Egyptian state down, to turn us over to banditry, lawlessness, violence, our enemies. So you can see another strand of nationalism being played on, which I don't think the Mubarak era kind of did as much as we're seeing with Sisi. And then to kind of go back to the European example of the early 1800s, we've got a lot of external support for Egypt. The UAE is a great example here recently, where they've invested $35 billion, which is 7% of the UAE's GDP, into Egypt to basically shore it up, because foreign currency deficit spending, I won't go into the economics too much. But you've got Saudi Arabia that support Egypt, but you've also got the West, the United States, UK, EU. The UK has given some money to Egypt recently. So has the EU. So has the World Bank. So, and this external support is important as well, because if you're a citizen in Egypt, I've not only got to go against the government, I've got to potentially go against the backers. Are they going to support the government with more money and weapons? So that can be a big disincentive as well. So I think Egypt's a really great case study for lessons learned by the current government. And there's other stuff we can discuss in a bit, but those are some things I wanted to highlight.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Lewis?
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of what Lewis says, actually, about everything Lewis says. But I think just to echo that, actually, would be the Arab Spring, I think, is sometimes misunderstood. It was not a single homogenous event. So it wasn't about, as some Western practitioners still think, or certainly did at the time, it wasn't about democratization of the Arab world. It really wasn't about that. People didn't want necessarily to be for something. They were just against the social injustice, and most people just wanted to survive, to be honest. So one of the reasons it failed, if that's the accurate word, is because there was no structure in terms of what's next. You know, the deep state was still the deep state in terms of the bureaucracy or all the rest of it, and there are, you know, many countries that still operate when they don't have an operating government. So there was nothing there to link on in terms of, right, this is what we all want. And you can read that across many of the nations, although it wasn't homogenous. You know, the common threads were the abject poverty. And of course, different organizations within those countries wanted different things. So you had the middle class that wanted to basically undermine the elite. But really, the bulk of the power was from the mass of poverty, and that's where you saw the huge, great big, you know, the Tahrir Square, for instance, you know, all the protests there. So it wasn't actually in favor of something. Now, what did that lead to? There's a lot to cover here, actually. I'll try and be brief there. That's really what, and it'd be easy for people to think that we're conflating Arab Spring with violent extremist organizations. But actually, the two were very much linked, because the VEOs, you know, the ISILs of this world, actually, they were organized. They did give something for people to believe in, yeah, however brutal that was at the time. So that's why it morphed into something more solid. But I think just going back to a couple of Lewis's final points were that, you know, the government certainly learned from it. There's no question about that. So an understanding of why social media can actually facilitate these things, and the shutting down of it to some extent, the you know, the superficial, again, as Lewis mentioned, sort of, right, we will improve your lot, we will improve the economy. And of course, you know, the sad side and the downside is a lot of these, or some of these nations, went into full all-out civil war. Mm. And of course, again, that at that stage, your average citizen just wants to survive.
Yeah, sure. Maria?
A lot of interesting points raised by both Lewis and Sean. I just wanted to touch on the role of the military in some of these countries. So as you both said, the grievances are there, and they often require a political actor or another actor, civil society actor, to take on that organizer role. the role of someone that can prevent, that can provide a plan for the next day, essentially.
Yeah.
And we saw that starting with Sudan back in 2019 with the mass protests, in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the military or part of the military stepped up in a way to take on that role violently, which led to a series of military coups, of military-led regimes that are essentially built on as a response to the same grievances, be it the insecurity due to the presence of militant organizations or just poor economic conditions. So we are now seeing a military transition, and to some extent, in many of those countries, rather than a political one or a grassroots one. And that's interesting because in terms of lessons learned from what we see in countries such as Mali, Burkina Faso nowadays, the military-led governments have significantly constrained the public space and social media as well, mm-hmm. which is slightly easier to do. So there is a significant media and social media crackdown going on in these countries that further inhibits any movements or mass movements.
Would it be fair to say that they have learned the lesson and they're using open source as a means of governing?
I would say, I'm not sure if that I would make entirely that statement, but certainly to some extent, they have used social media to try and shape a public opinion more favorable to either new foreign policy choices, new alliances that they're trying to form with actors such as Russia. So social media definitely played a role in that huge rise of anti-Western sentiment. Pro-military government sentiment in those countries.
But you can certainly monitor the sentiment, as Sean mentioned earlier. You can also track rising tensions that are evident in that sentiment analysis, and to some extent counter it with your own narrative in that, that information environment, can't you?
Indeed, definitely. And I would say that social media for those regimes can also play, can also become a really handy tool to try and identify specific figures within those movements and try to isolate them in order to further sort of repress them.
Okay, well, as ever, time will evaporate on us if we're not careful. So, James, I'm going to come to you first. You get the difficult task of helping us understand what the future looks like in your crystal ball in front of you. Where is this heading? It sounds like there isn't a likely Arab Spring revisited. But what are your thoughts? Do we see the conditions that are likely to, despite the lessons identified?
I think that fundamentally depends on what we're referring to when we say the Arab Spring. Are we talking about the likelihood of protests in North African, Middle East countries leading to regime change on an individual basis? In which case, I would say that there are certainly countries where that remains a possibility. You know, unfortunately, included chief among those is Tunisia, the origin of the original Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Since the election of President Saeed in 2019, the economy has continued to suffer. Unemployment has continued to rise. There are social tensions, especially now between Tunisians and sub-Saharan African migrants, that the president, through some of his speeches, has been accused of deliberately stirring. And there are large protests in Tunisia on frequent bases, as people campaign for a restoration of a democracy that they feel has been lost to them.
Yeah.
Do I necessarily see the likelihood of a contagion effect across multiple countries arising from that instance? I'm slightly more skeptical now. I think we've touched on it quite thoroughly that regimes and protesters have learned the lessons. And just as the regimes have understood how to utilize security forces and social media to control the narratives and to divide and conquer protesters where necessary, I think protesters have also learned that, you know, without sort of support of foreign backers or, you know, mass mobilization on a consistent basis, their options for kind of achieving sweeping change are rather constrained.
Yeah. Maria, do you agree with that? Is that the most likely outcome you think?
I agree with what James said in terms of that there is the contagion effect is unlikely. Let's put it that way. I think on the lessons learned both for regimes and protesters, and that would only apply, of course, I think, to some of the sub-Saharan African countries. There might even be a fear or an apprehension that creating that level of instability might open the space for, again, parts of the military actors that might want to take advantage of that instability to try and carry out a potent or insane military-led government. So that's one element. I think protests are not inherently bad, rather the opposite, are a sign of a mature democracy. So that's something that I think we should be keeping in mind, particularly in countries that are still in the early steps to some extent of a stronger democratic regime. So I would say that. And we also see that protests often have more focused requests, thinking of Kenya, that's currently ongoing. More focused requests that are also more easily tackled by the government.
Right, right.
So,
Lewis, your turn. What are your thoughts? Stare into the crystal ball for us.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with what Maria and James have broadly said, and I think the risk of contagion is much lower. I think what Sean emphasised at that a lot of groups don't and protests don't know what they're for, and that is the hardest bit of any revolution. And I think you can see this in terms of previous revolutions, where when the Iranian Revolution came, there was a while it was also quite chaotic, to be fair, it wasn't just one thing. It wasn't just the vision of Khomeini. There were competing Republican ideas, Democratic ideas, but you had those ideas percolating. You know, you had tapes and sermons by Khomeini coming into the country, inspiring the people to kind of latch on to the idea when the regime crumbled and protests broke out. I don't sense any of that. I don't sense an ideological current, whether it's liberal democracy or whether it's state capitalism or whether it's, you know, large reform. I'm not picking up through the open sources that level of cultural and social ideological activism across a lot of these countries. And I think that builds into me as well for, as I think Maria and James mentioned, the governments have learned to use social media so they can clamp down on organisation, which is a big disincentive. But there's an element of demoralisation, I think, kind of maybe globally, but definitely in times are tough. And the ability of the government to put their own narrative forward, to demoralise their population, to atomise them, to disincentivise them, to make them feel lonely, I think that also makes contagion less likely, let alone the individual national potential for this. And just one quick thing as well. I think it obviously, as James mentioned, it spread to the Gulf. What I think with the Gulf countries at the moment is economically they're doing very well. Also, they seem to have a new level of confidence in their own system, right? There's definitely, we can discuss the weaknesses, and that can be another podcast on Gulf monarchies with potential transitions of power with MBS and King Salman, etc. But there is, you know, there is the moral allure of the current of liberal democracy in the West, I would say, is kind of declined over the last 5 to 10 years, and with the rise of populism and our own problems. And that was just one potential element that protests could go. So the moral confidence of some of these states, I think, could act also as a barrier against any of these protesters to inspire themselves to take the risk. Anyway, that's some thoughts there.
Thank you. Just I really like the point about the demoralization effect or attempt to some extent, Lewis. And I think we shouldn't forget that for some of the countries, the levels of violence have significantly increased, primarily due to VEOs being particularly active. And that has led mass parts of the population to have to deal with survival. And that has further fragilized any public movement or any coordination effort. So in many of those countries, population has to deal with displacement, has to deal with threats for their livelihood, essentially. So,
looking after the food on the table and the roof over my head. Sean, I'm going to come to you last, but before I do that, I ask you to give your view. For the three of you, let me ask you this question, give you a moment to think about it. In the open sources, what are the one or two things you're going to be looking for that gives you that sense of the likelihood of an Arab Spring part two? What are the things you look for? I mean, Lewis, you touched on a couple of things about indicators and warnings. What are those things that you look for as an analyst in the open source environment? So while you're thinking about that, Sean, what's your thoughts about the crystal ball? What's your crystal ball telling you
So rather disappointingly, I have to agree with everything that's been said, which I don't like to know. It is, yeah. But I mean, you know, you need two things really to foment a revolution, if you want to call it that. You know, you need a political ideology, but also the organization that goes with it that people buy into. And then you need something to make it happen, whether that's the military or a pseudo-military. And right now, you know, the militaries know that they're onto a good thing. And a lot of these regimes, you know, support their military for that exact reason.
Yeah.
And of course, the economy matters as well. I was just going to double down on what Lewis said. You know, it's interesting that the only two places where, you know, and there was a little bit of a revisit of protests in 2019, but the only two that didn't see any of that were UAE and Qatar. Funny old thing, they're the ones that are economically strong. So what I do think, though, is that we need to keep monitoring each individual nation as a nation and overlay the big strategic stuff on it, the food insecurity, the energy insecurity, all that stuff that we're seeing as a result of the crisis in Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. Because so the factors are actually increasing that would increase that dissatisfaction. But the levers in terms of internally are not there really, I don't think, to foment that crisis. And there's another point to this, and this is about, and you've heard me say this many times, is that we do look at things through a very Western lens.
Mm.
So, you know, the idea, well, as we're seeing maybe now, you know, liberal democracy is not necessarily what everybody wants, put it that way anyway, and it might not necessarily be the right thing for everybody. So what is it they actually want, you know, and it is about the justice, equality and all the rest of it. You know, you look at Iran and, you know, every time there's a protest, it's, oh, yeah, it's about to go, it's about to go. And never does, because there just isn't, though, there aren't those things in place for that to happen. But back to what I was saying, we do need that local understanding of what the levers are, what's happening there, while looking at the strategic sort of bigger picture as well.
Very good. So as our colleagues talk about the things they're looking for in their open source sources, you and I will come back with our one takeaways at Friday the Insurance to give you a moment to think about it. So Lewis, starting with you, what are the things you're going to be looking for in those open sources you regularly tap into to give you a sense of what's actually going on here?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, at Jane's and in Country Intelligence, we do have a list of country stability indicators that we monitor very regularly. And we update with data, event data from the open sources through our own methodologies, through qualitative inputs and assessments. So we do have a range of political, economic and social indicators that we monitor quite regularly. To give a couple of examples of these, on the economics, we monitor the unemployment, the inflation, the deficit, to see the risks of to the economy. On the politics side, we do look at corruption. We look at the risk of coups and the relationship between the military and the government, as well as general instability. And then also, as we said on that, you know, the violent side, we do monitor non-state armed groups and their risk to state stability as a risk there as well. So we monitor through the open sources and our own methodologies these structural factors. And we do that hopefully quite well. And that gives us a good lens on which to start looking at the country from a macro perspective. But I think what's becoming interesting for me as I hopefully am developing my skills as an analyst through OSINT is we need to use that lens and then kind of really magnify and look at more specific things and not just the macro stuff, but as we've kind of talked about, some of the moral sides of what the population is feeling, the cultural sides, the philosophical sides. These aren't something we've quantified at the moment, but they are important aspects of being human, and therefore I think of where society might be going in these countries. We should treat them as their own cultural basis. We should make sure that we're taking their own hopes and kind of dreams for their country, not just, you know, a Eurocentric lens, as you said. So I think it's important for OSINT to start, you know, kind of, and national security analysts more generally, to start looking at countries maybe in a bit more this way as a guide to what could happen. You know, 1978 was interesting in terms of Iran. You know, US thought it was very stable. Next year, there's an Islamic revolution and a Republican revolution. It's messy, but we need to get those currents a bit more. So that's something I think I might be more cognizant of going forward.
Thanks, Lewis. Maria?
Completely agree with Lewis on the value of our CSIs. That's something that we definitely use as an early warning tool or to help us focus our research. Well, if I'm to answer your question through the...
That's the idea.
Before it happens, as it happens, I would say that before, we try to identify through open source research political figures, political position figures, actors, organizations within each country's environment that could possibly take on that role of the organizer or the leader of such a movement. Something that we are quite sensitive to and might indicate that something's about to happen is usually internet outages, crackdown on social media. So that's something that always makes us wonder what's happening, why is it happening, why is the government shutting down social media? And then when it happens, essentially we'll try to identify on social media any hashtags, any key themes, some rudimentary sentiment analysis to try and understand what the ultimate goal of the movement would be. Would it be end that government, we want someone new in place, or is it a more specific request? So
perfect. James, you got the enviable task now. I'm trying to find something that hasn't been said already. What's your thoughts?
First of all, I agree with Lewis and Maria.
We're going to have to have a podcast, but nobody agrees with each other.
Just as a kind of, I suppose, in a slightly different format, I would say when it comes to reviewing protests, there are key dynamics that need to be considered. For example, the persistence of those protests. Are they a kind of flash in the pan, you know, one Friday and they're done? Or are they day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out? The sort of scope of those protests in terms of what the people at the event are proceeding or are seeking with their demands, and also the buy-in from various different sectors of the society. So I know Lewis mentioned Iran and the recent protest there. Didn't receive a huge amount of buy-in from broader Iranian society. There was never really much sense that the Iranian military in any capacity or the security forces were changing their allegiance to side with the protesters, like we saw in Egypt after the security forces had rampaged through Tahrir Square. There were elements in the military who rejected those kind of tactics. And this kind of helps us understand and distinguish when a protest is just a emotional outburst and when it is a staging ground, right, potentially for something more more significant. All I would say to kind of conclude is we have to be aware that OSINT can kind of give us indicators and warnings and red flashing lights. It isn't necessarily going to guarantee that we can predict exactly when something will happen.
Sure.
For example, I'm sure that the protesters in the wake of Mohamed Bouazizi's self-immolation had no conception that their actions were going to inspire protests in, you know, half a dozen other Arab countries any more than, maybe a strange comparison, any more than the death of George Floyd was the single case that sparked the Black Lives Matter movement. There was no way of knowing that one incident would incite such a response.
Yeah, I'm sure academics would love to prove you otherwise because they want to see everything connected, but I do agree with you. Lewis, sorry, you wanted to come in at that.
Yeah, just great stuff by Maria and James there. And I think, when these protests do break out, some of the indicators Maria really highlighted well there. But, being an intelligence analyst with OSINT is still important. It's to take your tradecraft and your skeptical eye and your analysis and make sure you're, kind of trying to analyze this as dispassionately as possible in a very passionate sort of occurrence. It's, James mentioned the Iranian side of the protests and Mahsa Amini. Is the media, I think, did a disservice in terms of analyzing that and propagating that, because the media does what the media does. And they said it was Iran's revolutionary moment, and there was a lot of kind of doing up of that. Whereas we used a revolutionary factors model, which uses a lot of the stuff we organized about organization of the protesters, the elite cohesion of the security forces, the buy-in of certain demographics, the offensive ideological component. For us, that's important to retain during these sorts of moments and to remember our training and intelligence analysis tradecraft.
Perfect. So, Sean, it's for you and I to, first of all, thank you, James, Maria, and Lewis, and for us to give the audience what we think are the one takeaways that you're going to take from this. So I'll start with you.
So for me, and it's a blinding glimpse of the obvious, really, but everything is a surprise unless you're looking at it, which sounds a bit odd, but you know, the Arab Spring, all the factors were there. If someone had been looking at it in a holistic way, which is really my point, is that, you know, geography matters and you need to be looking at individual nations and even, you know, sub elements within there, but you've also got to do it in a holistic way. You know, people talk about intelligence failures all the time, and you know, which I could write a book out, in fact I might do actually, but it's not always intelligence failures necessarily, but where that there is things lacking is because they haven't joined up the thematics or the geography. So what's nice to hear is that people are looking, you know, the James analysts are looking at things from a both a geographic and a thematic perspective, because unless you join the two up, you're probably not going to join the dots.
Yeah, I think for me, of all things you've said, and I've enjoyed all of it, is that we may have some evidence here of countries learning from what happened in the early part of the last decade, the so-called Arab Spring, and that may actually have influenced the chances of happening again. Interesting to see whether that's true in another 10 or 20 years, because memories aren't that long. In a couple of generations from now, the Arab Spring will be very much a matter studied in history classes, but not necessarily learned from in the way that perhaps has been evidenced in this conversation. So let me finish by saying, thank you for the three of you to join us in this conversation. It has been fascinating, as always. Thanks to the listener for taking the time to listen to the conversation we've had here. And as I've said in the past, if anybody has any questions or any topics you'd like us to cover, we've done a couple of those at request, then please let us know. We'd be more than happy to cover them. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.